Please join me in the serenity prayer.
God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen.
Tonight, our 40-minute speaker is Jim from Laguna Beach.
My name is Jim. I'm an alcoholic. Sorry, right about here. My sobriety date is September 30th, 1994. Sponsor's Bobby D. My home group is the Saturday morning Whale Watcher Men's Stag at the Montage. And here we go. Wow. It's really great to be here. A lot of guys, you know, I just love the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, that sincerely. There's something that goes on. John Acklin always used to say, there's something that's going on in here. You know, it's really special. And I really feel it tonight. Well, let's see. I was born. No, I had nothing extraordinary go on in my early life. I had two great parents who, my father just passed in 2008. But my mom and dad had been together since they were 16, married a very long time, had an older sister. I was raised in Rochester, New York, and no toilet training issues, no big problems to think of that would have contributed to my alcoholism, I don't think. It was a pretty great upbringing, really, you know, and I think that probably like all of us, but I think everybody out there, too. At a certain point, I started feeling a little bit uncomfortable with what was going on around me. And I think a lot of times as alcoholics, we view ourselves as the only ones who feel that way. But I've got a lot of dear, sweet, not alcoholic friends who are really uncomfortable with themselves. And we moved to Southern California when I was 13 years old. And up to that point, my first 7 grades, I went to a small little Catholic school 1 block away from our house. We wore ties, and it was, you know, a very traditional thing. And I came out to California in 1972, and I went to a public school that was being built. They had no walls in the classrooms, and the girls wore low hip-hugger pants that were fantastic. And, you know, I remember it was a dear friend of ours, Michael. You know, I came out, and they made fun of me because I had what they called orthopedic underwear. You know, I had bun huggers, and they wore skivvies, and they all wore wallabies and hang ten shirts and cords, and I didn't have any of this stuff, you know. And you know, that isn't what made me an alcoholic. That's kind of what made me look like a fool. But, you know, I just I caught on pretty quick, and I bought my gear, and I went to school. In freshman year, my parents, the plan was for me to go to an all-Catholic boys' high school. And I pitched a fit. I said, hey, you guys moved me all the way out here, and I finally made some friends. It just isn't fair. And you know, I look back, and my poor parents were so overmatched with a 13-year-old kid like me. They were born in 21, and they were Depression-era people, and they did not know what this was. When they talk about the generation gap that was going on, they just didn't know what kids were up to, what they were doing, and things like that. And as a result, I could kind of manipulate my way. I had a very strict father, and I had an Irish mother, and so you could kind of play between the two of those pretty well. And they agreed to let me go to public school. My first year in public schools when I was introduced to drugs and alcohol. And I'm only going to make mention of drugs only anecdotally. It's not, you know, my story. I'm an alcoholic and I'm here to talk about my alcoholism, but I might talk about eating a whole pizza at one time, but I'm not here for an OA pitch. You know, I did smoke some weed and my first time I drank and my freshman year. A buddy of mine got some Boone's Farm and yeah, what was it? Annie Greenspring. No, that's what it was. Annie Greensprings, yeah. And the yellow zigzag rolling papers, I remember, and 4-finger lids. And, you know, we were freshmen. And something really cool happened then. You know, we whatever outsiders we felt like, we didn't feel much like outsiders after that. We had a clique of guys that were doing that kind of stuff. And coincidentally, that's the first year I got arrested when I was 14. I didn't get arrested for that. I got arrested because I was taking my driving very seriously at age 14, and I felt like I had to get started young. And when the police pulled me over, I gave them a fake name, and they thought I stole the car and turned into a little bit of a nightmare. And again, these poor parents of mine, I don't think they knew what was going on. They'd moved to California, and they didn't know what was going on. So, you know, for me, starting to drink at that point, for starters, the first thing I did when I drank is I got drunk right away. I mean, it wasn't like let's have two or anything like that. Everybody's whole point of view about drinking, at least in the group of guys that I hung out with, was let's get hammered, you know. Let's just get as much as we can in, and you drink till you just are gone. You either throw up, you black out. And there was no, it sounds crazy saying that stuff now about a 14-year-old kid, particularly since I have a near 13-year-old daughter, but, you know, that just was what it was. And it got to the point where, you know, we'd smoke a little weed before school, maybe take some cross tops and start having drinks at lunchtime, and, you know, that night I'd be out. And I reached a point with my mom and dad where I eventually, you know, they had a curfew, and I eventually just said, I'm just not going to do it. And what are you going to do? And I just came home whenever I came home. And there were nights, by the time I was, you know, 14, 15, 16, I just didn't come home. And I can't even imagine what that did to them. But I was having a great time. You know, I really was. I don't look back on any of that. None of it was a bummer. I had a great, great time doing all these things. I remember, you know, the parties that you'd have. Back then, it'd be Friday night. You'd walk around the quad at, you know, recess or whatever it was at school, and you'd say, where are the parties? And somebody'd say, oh, there's this one here, and you'd drive around with your buddies, drinking in the car until you found the one, you know, and it's the one that starts with the cars 2-3 blocks before, and you just see lines of cars. You go, this it? Maybe is this it? Yeah! You know? It's on! And these people's houses would be trashed. And you'd just be like, yeah, this is great! And my favorite story of that a lot of my friends here have heard, though, is this guy, Mark. He was... his brother, when he was a senior, was the football. He was the quarterback of the football team, and Mark was a freshman. He was the quarterback of the freshman team, and he was a big kid. He was like 210 when we were kids and freshmen. But between freshman and sophomore year, Mark lost all his hair. But this dude could grow a beard as a freshman, and he could buy us alcohol. And so, in our sophomore year, his parents went away to Kentucky. And that just meant he stayed home from school the whole time, partying, playing cards, doing whatever. And I was over at his house one morning and getting high, having a couple cocktails, whatever a normal 15-year-old does before school. And I said, hey, Crasser, you're having a big party Friday night. And he's like, I can't do that. My parents would kill me. Dude, you haven't been to school. Everybody's talking about the party you're having. You're having a big party. No way, you know. And I'm like, okay, well, we'll see. So I go to the football game, trashed, and do what we normally do. We'd split at halftime, and we go over to his house. And the first thing I see is just about a half mile away, the cars. And we're like, oh, he has no idea. And we're going up this long hill in Fullerton, and I see a white Datsun pickup coming down with a guy across the hood and the thing, and it's Mark. He's across it, just trashed. And, you know, it was, for me, a great night. A night that I'll never forget. I went in there. We had our own little room where we were doing all our extracurricular activities. The music was great. And the follow-up to that was his parents, you know, it was ruined. I mean, we went over to his house the next day. I was like, dude, you're never going to get this clean for your parents. It's never going to happen. But his parents were gone the whole next week. And I swear to God, that same thing happened the following Friday. And he did not believe it could happen because he hadn't been to school in 2 weeks now. And I was like, yeah, we're running that back. And we did that. And that's what it was like. I just had a great time. If we're going to play volleyball, we had a case of beer. Somebody, you know, there was a kegger party. We made sure we had our extra beer. And I got arrested when I was 16. We were having some beers and smoking a joint at 3 in the afternoon up off a street that we all used to go to because the cops never went there. And my buddy who I was with got in a big argument with the cops because he said, if we were 18, you couldn't bust us for the marijuana and blah, blah, blah. And then the cop found the pills and it was like, oh, maybe you better be quiet. And again, my mom and dad had to come down to jail and get me out. And that's when I dropped out of high school. I dropped out of high school then. I moved out of my parents' house for good. I'd moved out a couple times, but I moved out for good when I was 17. And I thought it was so cool because all my friends that were my age were seniors, and I was living on my own with a guy who was older. And they could come down, we'd play poker at night, and they had to go to school the next day, and I just kind of laughed at them like, losers, you know. Meanwhile, I was working for $35 a day, sun up to sundown, as a Mason's tender, and I weighed 135 pounds, and I was just getting worked. You know what I mean? It was hard, back-breaking work. But I was on my own, and it allowed me to do what I wanted to do. And, you know, at age 52, looking back on that, you know, I can see kind of see all the things that were present then. But at the time, it was just great. It was just great. And I would say for about the next 4 or 5 years, more or less, I continued on that path. And something started to happen when I got well into my 20s that was really uncomfortable to me, which was the hangovers started getting really hard physically. Like the next morning was like, you know, I used to be that guy that could drink all night and I'd shower and I'd be in work. I never missed work. I never got fired from a job, you know, and I would show up. Remember when people would say, dude, maintain. I could maintain. Like, you didn't know I was messed up. I knew how to maintain, you know. And I'd go to work and I'd do all that. But all of a sudden, the hangover started getting worse and worse and worse. And I don't know at what point it hit, but I started having, like, hangovers that would produce a physical depression in me. Like, sad, kind of a hollow feeling. And I remember saying, I feel really dark today after all that. And, you know, people would encourage me to drink my way through it. And inevitably, you'd have something, you know what I mean? But, you know, whoa, that was weird, you know, and really, really uncomfortable. I'm not a depressive personality by any stretch of the imagination, but I was getting really, really kind of scary. And anyway, this continued for a period of time. And one night, I remember I had gone to a basketball game. I'd moved up to Los Angeles for work. And actually, before that, let me go back. The first time I tried to get sober was in 1986. And I had to meet my girlfriend. It was December 20, 21st, something like that. And my girlfriend was coming up from San Diego to the Valley up in Los Angeles. And it was a Friday night. And I knew I couldn't drink that night. And I went to a show, and I was in the back with a guy who was working there, and he offered me a glass of wine, and it was in a glass. And it was at a concert, so normally at a concert it would come in a plastic cup, but he had a glass, and it was a red wine. And he filled it halfway up, like red wine glass wine drinkers do, and yes, Joe, thank you, you know, and we had our red wine, and when it got down to just a little bit left, he filled it to the halfway mark again, and went, thanks, Joe, you know, and I understood nothing about craving or anything like that, and he said, are you going to go upstairs? I said, sure, and he goes, well, let me give you some drink tickets, and peeled off 10 tickets, which allowed me to get free drinks at the bar, and I went up there, and I won't get into all the gory details, but my girlfriend got to the house at 8, I got there at 10 the following morning. And you know what? You know what's important about that for me? Is that's a night I made a specific decision not to drink. You know what I mean? I was powerless over alcohol sober. I couldn't stop myself from the first drink. I never knew what that looked like before. And now when I start looking back on some of my drinking, I can see powerless over alcohol when I started the craving kick in. I can't believe how much I would drink. Do you know what I mean? Like, you'd start drinking. My favorite thing to drink right now is a Ruby's milkshake. And if you give me one, I'll have half my other kids. You know, my kids, I buy them milkshakes. I'm like, Dad has to have tax. I have a little bit of theirs. I have a little bit of theirs, you know. Dad, no tax. I'm like, I need my tax. And then I'd have mine, you know, because I'm a pig. I'm, you know, more is good. And sometimes I may even have two. But let me tell you, at that moment, I don't feel good. It is not working for me. And I have to stop. And when I drank, I couldn't stop. I would not stop at two. I wouldn't stop till it was gone. You know, and I don't know how you physically drink that much liquid. It just is crazy to me. But that's a real interesting property about alcohol, is that we can drink so much liquid, you know, and just keep going. I immediately feel bad after two milkshakes. I don't feel bad drinking until 10 hours after I've stopped. Then I start to feel bad. So that craving piece is a key piece of the powerlessness. But I also saw the powerlessness over the first drink as well that they talk about on page 24. Anyway, I made a phone call to my buddy Michael, who had just gotten sober a year before. And I went to an AA meeting, and I liked it right away. He said, I couldn't believe it. Like, you were into it. And I was. I thought it was great. I was something of a seeker. You know what I mean? Like, hey, if something works, let's try it. But it didn't stick. And it didn't stick not because AA doesn't work. It didn't stick because I didn't do any of the stuff. And quite frankly, nobody gave me the guidance. You know, and we have three new people here tonight. And I welcome you. Happy birthday to the birthday guys, too. And our visitor from our one visitor, you know. We need to tell these people who are new, there is something that you have to do. You've got to do all 12 steps, and then you've got to take somebody else through those 12 steps. And if you do that, you won't drink. And that didn't happen for me. I didn't do any step work, and I drank after, I don't know exactly. But after that, I had the worst drunken episode that I've ever had. I had gone to a basketball game, and I'd come home, and I had a large bottle of Kahlua that somebody had given me. Again, it was the holiday time. And I drank that while reading magazines after the game. And my roommate came home. And I had a proposal for him that I would pay for the alcohol and entertainment if he would procure that for us. And he did. And we had a lot of drinks and some very nice entertainment. And, you know, a lot of bad stuff happens when you get that drunk. And one of the bad things that happened for me is I, and this is important, not because it's a drug story, but because there's a lot of new people, and sometimes people go out and you get drunk and you do drugs and street drugs, and they're really not good for you. And I did a bunch of street drugs that night, and I thought I was going to die. And I just remember, you know, one more time, duct tape in the window, the blinds over the windows, and hearing the sprinklers go, and the paper hit the driveway, and life coming to on a Saturday morning, and feeling like this is not a life worth living. And I had all the hangover of my alcoholism, plus this other nonsense that was in me, and it was bad. It was the worst, to this day, the worst I've ever felt drinking. It wasn't my bottom, though. Although I did get sober then, and I stayed sober for 3.5 years. And I got a sponsor, and I worked the steps. I went to retreats. I sponsored guys. So now I've diagnosed my problem. You know, I've found out what the deal is. I know what I need to do to fix it. I do it. And in about 2.5 years, I have a Thursday night meeting I'm not going to go to. And I look at that Thursday meeting, and I just got a lot going on. I'm working. I'm very busy with my work. And I'm stressed. I got a lot of stuff, and I need a night off. And the thing that I needed to eliminate was that Thursday night meeting. And I eliminated it, and I like to say I didn't get the big AA wart on my forehead. Nothing was a big, like, look out, you're heading in a bad area. The truth of the matter is nothing happened. I didn't feel any different after skipping that meeting. And that following week when I skipped it again, I didn't feel any different either. I was like, you know, this is fine. I need that Thursday night back. And I got to a point where I went a full year without going to any meetings, which I considered cracking the code. You know, like, I don't have to do this 3, 4, 5, however many times a week. I don't have to sit with strangers in the bottom of auditoriums or churches or, man, this is great having all this time back. And one night at a sushi bar, small little glass and some little logo on it, and that big can of Sapporo that bubbles so nicely, the way it pours at a sushi bar, I was powerless. And I just needed that small glass of beer. And what happened for me was not I drank, I felt really bad, and I came back on Monday. I went out for 18 months. I didn't return my sponsor's calls. I didn't return my sponsee's calls. I moved from L.A. to Laguna Beach. And I drank like I never knew was possible. Like, I would drink and all by myself all night. And the next day I'd get up and I have that stomach that you're like, oh my God, am I going to throw up? Like, oof, you know. And I'd at the bathroom to go to the bathroom. I'm like, oh God. God, please. I can't do this anymore. And those prayers were as sincere as any prayers I ever would say in my life, even to this day. And man, I felt horrible. And I would make my tuna casserole vitamin B12 concoction that I thought was the hangover cure that would work for, you know, for me. And you know, crush out the B12s in the thing. You know. Squirt. Anybody have squirt? You just have squirt? Yeah, squirt, you know, squirt with the tuna casserole. You know. And I'd swear I was not going to drink again. And I'd say, God, whatever. And that afternoon, I didn't want to get drunk, but I just needed a beer. And I'd start that whole cycle all over again. And I could not stop, you know. And it was a Thursday night in Laguna. I had moved here on a Saturday. And I'd gone to Thursday without drinking. And I said to a guy that I was working with, let's go get a basket of chips. Let's check out Laguna. We went to Las Brisas. And it was 4 in the afternoon. And we had a basket of chips and a margarita. We had another margarita. And it was like, all good. We live in Laguna now. Isn't this cool? Let's go check out Laguna. So we went across the street to Hennessy's. And they had Watney's on tap. And we got a Guinness and mixed them. This is Laguna's great. You know, Laguna is really cool. And we walked across the street to the Marine Room. And the last thing I remember about the Marine Room, really, was hugging him, having smoked a whole pack of cigarettes. He didn't smoke, and he was smoking with me, and going, smoking and drinking, isn't this the greatest? Like, just ridiculous. But we hadn't eaten dinner, so I said, let's go to Johnny Rockets and get a bite to eat. It was like 12:30, and they were closed, so we had to get in the car and go to Ruby's. And I don't remember exactly what happened. I do know the police report said I was weaving around the wrong side of the road. And the next morning when I got out of jail on Forest Avenue, he pulled up. Bless you, Dan. He pulled up, and I'd called him from that little British phone booth right there. And he pulled up to pick me up, and I get in his car, and he goes, smoking and drinking, huh? And I'm like, oh, geez, you know. And that was a Friday, and Friday night I went to the Cannon Club. There were 4 or 5 people there at the old Canyon Club. And that Saturday night, I went to the Saturday night speaker meeting in Laguna Beach. And when I got in there, I realized that about 6 years before then, I had spoken at that meeting. And it freaked me out. I couldn't believe, because that South Coast Hospital is kind of a labyrinth to get into the auditorium, if you've ever done it. And I'd done it coming from L.A. in the rain. And so I'm like, whoa, I've spoken here. And I went up and I got my newcomer chip and a hug. And I'm like, wow, this is weird. Something happened, though, and what happened for me at that point, I was willing to do whatever it took. I mean, I really was, like, whatever it took. And I eventually got this small, mean man of questionable sexual orientation. I shouldn't say that. Who knows what it was. But he didn't want me to date that first year, so I was concerned about what was going on with him. And I didn't date, and I didn't drive my car because I'd been arrested, and I thought that just meant don't get caught driving your car. But I did everything he said. And I didn't know then what he was doing to me, but he was creating some space for some humility. And that would be the space that would allow God to come in. And I didn't even believe in God. You know, I was like, God, oh, jeez, I was raised Catholic. Do I need to hear this too? Like, but I went to 15 meetings a week. And I was 35 years old. And I was running my own business. And it was great. I mean, it really was great. There were a group of guys that we all hung out with, and we all drove. They drove me everywhere, and we would golf and hang out and do stuff. And all I did was Alcoholics Anonymous. And that sounds really corny to me. Not now, but it would have sounded corny to me then. If you're new and it sounds corny to you, I totally understand it. But I was terrified. I couldn't. I was starting to get a little space between my drinks. You know, Thursday was the longest time. You know, now all of a sudden I'm getting a few weeks, a month, some time, and I don't want what I was doing. That thing was horrible. I had broken the chain a little bit. So I did whatever they told me. And a lot of times I did it even when it didn't feel right to me, you know, I wasn't singing. When it's singing, it's easy. When you're loving doing it, it's great. When it's like, hey, we're all going to this, great. You know, when it's like, I don't want to do that tonight, or I got something else, or, but I did it all anyways. And, something started to change. And, you know, I developed a fellowship, and a lot of guys are here tonight, and I say this a lot, fellowship is way bigger than friendship. To me, you know what I mean? I've had a lot of friends over the years, and I still have a lot of friends, but there's nothing like the fellowship. And it is that key piece of the triangle, the unity side. And I love our fellowship. And I was starting to develop a fellowship with men who I knew had done the things I'd done. And then it was time to do the steps. And I was pretty clear on the first step that I was powerless over alcohol when I drank it, and I was powerless over it before I drank it. I couldn't stop. And I was certainly unmanageable when I drank. I'd proven that by driving on the wrong side of the road. But I got stuck a lot of times with this unmanageable piece when I'm sober. How's my life unmanageable? And you know, God, I don't know why John A's on my mind, but, you know, John always used to say, drinking isn't our problem, sobriety is. And we're in the car, and Dan goes, oh, nice tie. And you know, my wife gave me this tie for Christmas. Why is she giving me a tie for Christmas is my attitude. What are you doing giving me a tie for Christmas? I don't wear ties to work. I don't wear ties at all. What a ridiculous gift. This is me thinking at Christmas time, you know, time of love and charity. I'm like, tie? And you know what else is wrong with this tie? It's purple, her favorite color, not mine. So I'm like, what a ridiculous gift this is. And this is the brain I've got. And I could go through my day like that on a million different things. And that's the unmanageability of my life. I make myself filled with fear, resentment. I look at my kids act out. I think they're going to act like that way forever. I did a poor job as a parent. They're going to turn into that. They're going to turn into me, you know, and pretty soon you're just tightening the spring, you know? And, I don't know about you guys, but a drink works really well on that. For me, it does anyways. And I can't do that anymore. So I've got to do this other thing. And I kind of want to turn third base and head home with what I needed to change that. What I needed is to have a spiritual experience. You know, they define it in the book. They talk about it on page 27 where he says it's a complete change of attitudes, ideas, and emotions. And I'm thrilled to be out on a Friday night here. That's a complete change of attitudes, ideas, and emotions for me. Tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock, I'll be in a meeting. Thrilled to be there. That's a complete change of attitudes, ideas, and emotions. And I see it in a lot of places in my life. I see it when I don't say that thing I need to say to my wife on Christmas about the silly tie she gave me instead of, I don't know, some golf balls would be cool. You know, I use those. I don't even need the tie. I got two ties. I don't need a third. You know? But what's happened is I worked the first three steps. You know, I did the first one where I realized my life's unmanageable. I realized I'm completely the insanity that they talk about in the big book is the insanity that I can't stop myself from taking that first drink, even when the consequences are going to be horrible. And that somehow a power can save me from that. And when I choose to rely on that power, not just believe in that power, rely on that power, something starts to happen. And I went through all my junk, all my resentments, and I went through all my fears. And I wrote down all the sex stuff, how selfish it was. And I've told several men this stuff, and it freed me. And I was able to see the patterns, and they came up and they directed me to 6 and 7, where my character defects were. And I was able to start working on those things and asking God to remove them, you know. And it took me a long time. I had to make the sex prayer in the book part of my daily prayer routine because I was married and I didn't want to cheat on my wife. But I couldn't help let's see, every attractive woman. Like, maybe I should just drive all the way to Seal Beach, you know, just because she was cute and I'm going to go. Because that's what I did when I was 14 or 15 or 16. But I'm like, I can't do that, man. This is wrong. I'm like, ah, why do I feel this way? I married this wonderful girl. I don't like this. And I had to pray about that. And God removed that from me, you know. That's a big deal. And I had to go and start making some amends. And I did that. I wrote down my list and I made the amends. And I got free of this stuff. And what happened for me at 11 years of sobriety, my mom was in the hospital. First time she'd been in the hospital since 1959 when I was born. And she's a little Irish woman. She's 90 now. And spent a lot of time taking care of her. But her colon had burst, you know, and she was in bad shape. And she's 5'4" and little green eyes. She's a Murphy, little Irish lady. And the doctor said we have to go through this mainline procedure where we go through her carotid artery to put the mainline in. It's how we'll dispense drugs and keep monitor her. And could you do me a favor and just look into her eyes and keep her as still as you can be while I do this? And my dad is over in the corner and he gives me the nod, like, go ahead, you do it. I'm like, thanks, pal, you know, you do it. But I get down next to her, and I'm looking side by side at this little Irish lady, these little green eyes, and she's blind. She's legally blind. She can't see me, but she can feel my nose right there. And I'm like, Mom, it's going to be okay, and they're doing this. I'm like, whoa, gnarly, the blood spurted. And it did spurt, like, literally, you know. It's crazy. And I'm like, oh, God, please, if this is it, be merciful. Please, God, please, you know. And I'm praying the prayer like we pray, you know. And they do the procedure, and it works out fine. They take her off, and I go in the corner. It's empty, and I just sob. I'm just, like, terrified that my mom's going to die. But something struck me at that moment, it's the first time, is that page 52, God either is everything or he's nothing. God either is or he isn't. How come he is at this moment, but the rest of the time, yeah, God, you know, really? God. And I wondered about that, you know, because I've had such trouble with God my whole life, you know. And I said, well, that God that I'm using then has to be the same God that's out there, whether I choose to acknowledge it or not. And from that moment forward, I actually started to believe in God. And I still struggle with it, but I think that's natural. I think we're not supposed to all... The guy who understands who God is needs his meds checked, usually. You know what I mean? That guy who's like, I got it, God. I talk to him all the time. We're like this. It's like, I totally understand it. That's usually the guy at the end zone holding the sign, you know? But nobody I know, you know? That's just not how it works, usually. We're kind of human, and we don't understand it. We don't have great clarity about that stuff. And I think that's okay, and I need to accept it. You know, it's funny. I'll tell you guys something. I asked my sponsor, Bobby. He spoke here last Friday. And I go, so, Bobby, how long do I go? He goes, you go to 9:40. I go, 9:40? Really? The meeting ends at 9:30? He's like, 9:40 is when I finish. I'm like, wow. It's 9:16. I'm not going to 9:40. So I'm looking to go, okay, I'm going to wrap up. If I went to 9:40, you could blame Bobby. There's a great thing in the book where it says, no human power can relieve our alcoholism, but God could and would if he were sought. And that freed me of the obligation of finding God. I don't have any business finding God. It's not mine to do. I just got to keep seeking. And in that process of seeking, I get the recovery that I need for my alcoholism. That's all I've got to do is just seek. And I just really appreciate everybody being here tonight. What a great thing we've got, you know. This is so much better than the way we used to live. Thank you. Yeah.